Despite all the public attacks on the press we've seen from the Trump administration so far, it has also been one of the leakiest, one of the most sensational leaks of a proposed executive order that would have allowed widespread discrimination against LGBT people was reported last week by my friend Sarah Posner in The Nation. Sarah, it's good to talk with you once again.
It's good to talk with you too, Jay.
So this was really a big scoop. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what you discovered?
Well, someone leaked to me the draft of an executive order that was entitled Establishing a Government-Wide Initiative to Respect Religious Freedom. It was about 4 pages long, and from what I could glean, it was causing a great deal of alarm in the LGBT, civil liberties, church-state separation, advocacy communities. Because it would just very broadly enable just about anybody to claim a religious or even a moral objection to another human based on their sexual orientation, their sexual conduct, their private sexual behavior. It was extremely broad. And the draft order had other provisions in it as well, including an effort to repeal the Johnson Amendment. I had been reporting on these kinds of issues for so long that I recognized the document as basically being like a laundry list of things that the religious right has been trying to do incrementally for many years, all kind of laid out in an executive order. And in the context of what had happened with Trump's Muslim and travel ban executive order, where it was immediately subject to a court challenge, as this one would be if he signed it too, it created a lot of chaos, harm, and anxiety in the interim. And so given that set of circumstances, it was, I think, important to get it out there because of how the circumstances around the Muslim and the travel ban one had played out.
I wonder if you were surprised that this draft at least circulated so early in the administration, you know, that basically in the first week of the Trump administration, the entire laundry list was about to be signed into an executive order.
Well, you know, it's still not clear how far along this draft was in the process, but let's remember that the process under Trump has not been the normal process where the draft would be circulated to the relevant agencies that would be tasked with implementing it, or that the draft had been vetted by the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. It was not clear that this draft that came into my hands had been through those processes. And we also knew that Trump's prior executive orders also hadn't been through those processes. So, given these circumstances, it was a little hard to say how far along it was or how close it was to being signed. But the White House didn't dismiss this. They basically said, well, we don't have a plan to sign an executive order on that topic at this time, which definitely leaves it open. So I guess under other circumstances and other presidents, I think it would be very surprising to have this laundry list being circulated about and being considered to be signed in one fell swoop. But given the breadth and scope of some of the other executive orders that Trump had signed, I guess in an odd way, it was not that surprising.
So, you know, I think most of our listeners probably know that, you know, there were then rumors that it was actually Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner who somehow derailed this executive order from being signed. Just curious for your take on that narrative.
Well, from the reporting that I read, it wasn't clear who the inside source was that leaked the Jared and Ivanka story to both Politico and The New York Times. You know, it might have possibly even, I think, under these circumstances, we'd have to consider the possibility that it was one of the Kushners themselves. But the reporting, both in Politico and in the New York Times, made pretty clear that there was one issue that they had raised concerns about with President Trump. And that was Obama's executive order that prohibited employment discrimination by federal agencies and contractors against people based on sexual orientation. That is also, you know, basically getting rid of that executive order is also part of this draft that was leaked to me. But that is just one tiny component of it. It otherwise basically blew this giant hole open to discriminate against LGBT people in almost every area of life. So the fact that the Kushners had reportedly gone to the president and said, don't reverse that Obama executive order, to me did not exactly cover all the bases of saying don't sign this expansive executive order that's making the rounds in the administration.
My guest is investigative journalist Sarah Posner. Her blockbuster report in The Nation exposed a cruel anti-LGBT proposal that the White House was working on. So, yep. You know, if you look actually at you know, the number of the smaller government contractors who mm-hmm. were covered by the non-discrimination order, this exemption would cover a majority of them. You know, any small, closely held contractor organization, not, you know, Exxon, let's say, but some of the smaller ones would be able to discriminate against LGBT people by the corporation explaining that it had religious liberty. So, you know, some of our listeners might not understand how a corporation could have religious beliefs. Maybe you could preach to us about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, that was basically the holding in the Hobby Lobby case. And if you look at this executive order, and we printed a complete copy of it with my piece. So anybody who's interested in reading it in its entirety can go look there. It's basically taking the Hobby Lobby case where the Supreme Court held that this closely held corporation, the Hobby Lobby stores, could raise a religious objection to providing the contraception coverage to their employees that's required under the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, the religious right was thrilled with that victory, and a lot of what it's been doing in the area of religious exemptions since then has been, you know, efforts to expand that beyond the contraception context and potentially, I think, beyond the closely held corporation context. But once you've extended it there, I mean, it's obviously like it would also apply to individuals, a court clerk who doesn't want to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. But I think another important thing to recognize, the Obama executive order prohibiting the employment discrimination by federal contractors does not apply to federal grantees. And many faith-based organizations that get federal funding get that funding under grants, not contracts. And Obama's order did not cover them. And so this executive order would really expand or give a license to federal grantees like that who say get federal funding to do foster care or some other kind of social service. And this would enable them to say, oh, you know, I don't want to provide foster care to this trans kid, or I want to provide reparative therapy to this gay kid, or, you know, you can imagine the various scenarios that could play out with such a broad exemption. The story about Ivanka and Jared prevailing on him about the Obama executive order doesn't cover all the bases.
So if we work on the assumption that this was a setback for whatever reason. So this draft circulated, it was not yet released. As you pointed out, it wasn't unreleased either. It wasn't that the draft was disclaimed. It just said, well, we don't have a plan to release it right now. Mm-hmm. What should listeners be looking for? I mean, it feels as though the political religious right, you know, that put this administration in the White House, let's mm-hmm. remember, they're not going to stop with this one small setback. Presumably, they're going to want a much more broader-based national so-called religious liberty law. I'm wondering, you know, what you think is next for the kinds of actions that we saw in this draft executive order.
Well, for starters, the religious right wants Trump to sign this executive order. Leading figures on the religious right called for it to be signed publicly after my story broke the news about it. Ryan Anderson, who I'm sure you're familiar with, he's an outspoken opponent of marriage equality at the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank. He wrote a column basically saying that Trump should sign this thing, that it's lawful and right. And other people on the religious right weighed in as well. Brian Fisher, the radio show host who's, you know, incendiary homophobe, he tweeted that if Trump were to sign this, that he would be the Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln of religious liberty. And other religious right groups are urging their supporters to write to the White House, to write to President Trump and Vice President Pence, urging him to sign this thing. So that's the first thing. The second thing is with regard to one element of the executive order, and that's the repeal of the Johnson Amendment, which is the part of the Internal Revenue Code that prohibits electioneering by churches and other houses of worship. Trump vowed to totally destroy the Johnson Amendment. He said that at the National Prayer Breakfast last week. And the same week, members of Congress introduced legislation that would repeal the Johnson Amendment. If they got that through both houses of Congress, Trump would certainly sign it. He's pledged to totally destroy the Johnson Amendment. And then that would open up churches to be able to basically openly campaign for Donald Trump, who's already declared his candidacy, basically, for the 2020 election. That's front two. Front three is the First Amendment Defense Act, which in many ways would accomplish many of the same things that the executive order would accomplish in terms of these broad religious exemptions. That's been floating around in Congress. Some versions of it have been introduced in state legislatures, in a handful of state legislatures so far this legislative session. So I would look for the FADA, as it's known as, the First Amendment Defense Act, to start potentially making its way through Congress. I don't know that it's at the top of Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan's agenda, but I think that there will be people trying to push it, and there will be state versions of it that we'll see being pushed in state legislatures.
So a lot of folks, when you raise some of these issues, you know, even just the name First Amendment Defense Act suggests that this is just about balancing, right? So there have been all of these changes in LGBT equality, in particular over the last several years, and that this is just a way of balancing LGBT equality with the religious liberty of people who may not want to provide a service facilitating a wedding, for example. So, you know, think of the example of Kim Davis, who, as I understand it, would be covered by the First Amendment Defense Act. So basically would be able to say Kim Davis as an individual clerk could say, well, I don't want to be part of a same-sex marriage, so I'm not going to sign this particular certificate. Someone else can. But, you know, what's the harm in that? I mean, how do you respond to the claim that this is just a balancing of different interests?
Well, it's definitely an expansion or a subversion of how the courts have negotiated the balance between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. So that balance is that, you know, obviously, like, you know, the Free Exercise Clause is, you know, we all cherish the Free Exercise Clause because that's what gives everyone in this country religious freedom, right? But the Establishment Clause prohibits the government from giving a stamp of approval, if you will, to one particular religious view, and particularly prevents the government from doing that when it causes harm to third parties. Now, let's remember that the Hobby Lobby case was not decided under the Establishment Clause. It was decided under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And many of these FADAs, which are much broader, would be probably subject to a challenge under the Establishment Clause. So the argument there is that the Establishment Clause says that the government can't say, oh, this particular religious view is entitled to some special protection, and particularly that's the case when there's harm to third parties. So the harm to third parties is, you know, they can't get their marriage license, they have to go to another county, or they have to wait for another court clerk to get there, or what have you. And in other instances, the harm could be even worse, you know, like a trans child not provided the right treatment, or a gay kid subject to reparative therapy, or a woman who had had an abortion being refused a job or housing or something like that. You know, like, these are all things that are kind of within the scope of the broad exemptions in this draft order. So really that is the argument. Like, the courts have always balanced the rights granted by the Free Exercise Clause and taken those rights very, very seriously, but also taken the Establishment Clause very seriously to say, like, look, it's not the government's job to say, okay, this religious view is, you know, so the religious view that opposes LGBT rights is not entitled to some more special protection than the religious view that says LGBT people should have equal rights, right? And then also taking into account the harm to third parties.
I just wonder, you know, as a fellow journalist, with facts being so disrespected these days, I know that you and I are both mourning the victims of the Bowling Green massacre, which was a really important massacre.
You shouldn't even, joke about these things. You shouldn't even joke about these things.
You know, how much harder is it to do the work that you do, you know, which is investigative reporting and actually trying to get at facts when, you know, the whole notion of facts, I mean, you know, when do we get your expose on the Bowling Green massacre?
So, yes, I mean, I think that the use of, and I don't even like to call it fake news anymore, because fake news is I think, just something different than what is happening right now. And what it's really a disinformation campaign. It's a campaign to put out information that helps the president and diminishes his perceived enemies. It's an effort to cause people to question their sense of, like, well, who do I trust? Do I trust the New York Times anymore? The president says they're fake news. The president says that they're terrible and that they lie about him. And it's a campaign against truth and reality and the media and institutions like we've never seen in our lifetimes. And I do think that by and large, the media has done a good job at pushing back on this. I mean, I think that as far as particular outlets, that sometimes there are certain reporters or anchors who do a better job than some of their colleagues. But I have been heartened by the stories that you hear about the huge uptick in subscriptions to the New York Times, or even the tremendous amount of donations that flowed into the ACLU in the wake of all of this. You know, so I do think that people are waking up to the fact that institutions, including the media, including the judiciary, including our government, they do matter and they do provide, reality-based, factual information and news. And to resist the efforts of the administration to try to alter your sense of reality or to try to gaslight you or to pound you with disinformation is probably one of the most important political acts that anybody can be doing right now. And I don't care if you're a political activist or the most objective journalist reporter out there. This is like you have to do this because our institutions depend on it.
That is really helpful. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on religious folks in particular. And I'm just wondering what people can really do at this point. You know, thinking about, for example, the recent protest at the Trump Tower with several of our mutual friends and rabbis getting arrested. What's the impact of actions like that, kind of religiously motivated actions in this context?
Well, I think that the more those types of actions take place, like civil disobedience by rabbis and that sort of thing, I think that it raises people's attention to the fact that the religious right is not the only religious game in town. And they're certainly getting a lot of attention right now. And they're certainly the favorites of the president because they were the constituency that helped get him elected. He owes them payback and he doesn't have really much regard for religion outside of the fact that he considers the religious right useful to his election. You know, I think a lot of the public tends to think of like, oh, religion and politics, that's always the religious right. And I think that the more politically active non-religious right actors get involved, then I think that that's only going to increase people's awareness that there is another kind of religion and that all religion has not been co-opted by electoral politics, that they're very much engaged in politics, but not at the service of getting somebody elected, at the service of making a political statement.
Sarah Posner, thank you so much. Sarah is an investigative journalist who broke a major story about the proposed anti-LGBT so-called religious liberty executive order in The Nation. Her writing also appears in Rolling Stone, The Atlantic, Washington Post, many other publications. Sarah is also the author of the book God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah Posner, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Jay.